Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Two strikes against gay marriage today. The Georgia Supreme Court upheld that state's constitutional ban on gay marriage, reversing a ruling by a lower court judge. And in New York, the state's highest court ruled that same-sex marriage is not allowed under state law, and the state legislature would have to change the law to allow same-sex marriage. 44 couples had filed suit in New York. Earlier today, we spoke to one of those plaintiffs, 33-year-old Alice Muniz of Brooklyn.
I think that with this ruling, we lose out in a lot of the mundane rights that every other married couple has. Stability for your family, most importantly, and just equality in the eyes of the law.
With today's decisions, Massachusetts remains the only state to allow gay marriage. And for more analysis on the New York decision, we turn to New York University law professor Stephen Gillers. So first of all, they seem to be saying that the power to make this decision lies with the legislature.
Exactly right. And it identified the reasons why the legislature may have limited marriage to heterosexual couples, and those reasons mainly deal with the protection of children. The majority said that the legislature could conclude that children grow up in a better environment if there's a mother and a father, and that's a rational basis for the ban on gay marriage. And second, it said that, and remarkably, that the legislature may have chosen to afford the benefits of marriage to heterosexual couples because it is only heterosexual couples who can, in a moment or accidentally, through casual sex, have a child, and by offering the benefits of marriage, this encourages the marriage and therefore the stability of the married relationship for that perhaps unplanned child.
We want to hold you up there because that point is going to be, I would think, controversial. The claim that only heterosexual couples could have children together. Of course, gay couples have children through many means.
The court recognized that. The court said, however, that gay couples have children through planning, whereas heterosexual couples can have children through accident or casual sex, and that therefore, the court said, the legislature may have wanted to offer the benefits of marriage to heterosexual couples who have unplanned children to get married so their children are raised in a stable environment. It's a rather bizarre holding because it's a backhanded compliment to gay couples who take the time to adopt or have children through other technological means rather than casually, and the court is saying that, well, they don't need the protection of marriage or the inducement of marriage in order to raise their children in a stable environment, whereas the casual sex of heterosexual couples may require that incentive.
This, I'm sure, is going to get quite a reaction.
Oh, I think this is a remarkable decision, and I think the gay community will look at the rather dismissive way that the court responded to its arguments with alarm and concern. They didn't just lose, but they lost in a way that I would call dismissive of their claims.
What did the court, the majority on the court, say to the complaints of the plaintiffs that a ban on same-sex marriage is akin to, you know, a ban on interracial marriage, or further, that it was homophobic?
The plaintiffs argued that the right to marry was a fundamental right and could not be burdened in the way that the legislature had done, and they did cite the miscegenation cases. The majority said that race is different, universally recognized at the time of the Supreme Court decision banning anti-miscegenation laws as inappropriate, whereas marriage between a man and a woman has for centuries been the dominant, if not the exclusive, recognized relationship.
And what does this mean for other states? What does this mean countrywide?
The fact that New York went the way it did probably sounds ominous to the plaintiffs in other states. New York is a persuasive state because it tends to be a liberal state. The fact that it rejected the claim here will probably discourage plaintiffs and courts in other states from getting on the Massachusetts bandwagon.
New York University law professor Stephen Gillers on today's ruling in New York banning same-sex marriage. Professor Gillers, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we have more news coming up out of London, out of Washington, but we want to spend a few minutes today with one legend talking about another. Choreographer George Balanchine was famous for saying, "Ballet is woman." Well, for many, ballet is one woman, Suzanne Farrell, Balanchine's last and some say greatest muse. Farrell was a teenager in the 1960s when Balanchine, 42 years older, fell in love with her. She loved him back in her own way.
There's something really daunting and wild about having your first love be this god, this man that you admired and wanted to dance for all your life.
That's Suzanne Farrell from Elusive Muse, the 1996 documentary about her life. And elusive she was. She refused to marry Balanchine or sleep with him. She even left his company, the New York City Ballet, but returned to resume her role in Balanchine's creative life until his death in 1983. She now runs the Suzanne Farrell Ballet, which is dedicated to performing the works of George Balanchine. And she joins us from the Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in Western Massachusetts, where her company is performing this weekend. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And when you say that your group is dedicated to preserving these works, what is it about them you preserve? I mean, just the steps, the choreography, what more is there?
There's so much more to Mr. Balanchine than just the steps. The choreography has to have his philosophy, his musicality, and the openness to not have the same performance every time you dance it. And I want these ballets to be not a memory, but memorable, because memory is past and memorable is present. And so every time we dance these ballets, they should evoke a newness in the dancers, in the audience point of view, and also in the Mr. B's aliveness in the present.
How do you do that? Because, Balanchine himself compared his ballets to flowers or butterflies, meaning they were ephemeral. And he dismissed some ballets as, becoming museums, I guess static, which is exactly the opposite of what you're talking about. So how would you do that if you can give us some insight?
I think it also goes back to class and how I like to have the classroom atmosphere the way Mr. Balanchine had it, rather experimental, not to have everything perfect, because then that's limiting. And that takes trust on the part of the dancers towards me, which was also the way Mr. B and I worked. So, those things are probably more important than the choreography etched in stone.
Right. For those of us who are not dancers, can you give us an example of that, a physical movement that might illustrate that?
Well, I guess sometimes maybe in rehearsal I'll say, well, that's nice, but show me something else. I don't ask them for anything specific to see what they would want to bring out.
That's so interesting to hear because as someone who loves ballet, but from the outside, it feels to me as if when I see Swan Lake, they're all doing the same things they're supposed to do. And it's sounding like you're saying that there's more improv there. It might be more nuanced, but there's more of that than we think.
I wouldn't say improvisation, but I would say spontaneity. I don't ask any of the dancers to be like me. I give them all the information that I've accumulated over the years. And it's like a recipe. Someone gives you a recipe for something that you ate and you love, and you go very much by the recipe the first time you make it. But after you've made it, you add a little of yourself or you take a little bit away, and that's the way a performance should be. You can't, the more you, certainly with my dancers, the more you give them some freedom, the more they give back.
Huh. You refer to George Balanchine as Mr. B, and we spoke of the relationship that you had with him. How would you describe it?
I get this question all the time, and it's almost impossible to describe. I think a lot of it is destiny. Who would have thought a young girl from Cincinnati would have her orbit intersect with Mr. Balanchine, even though I looked at his picture in Dance Magazine and dream that something like that would happen. You don't really expect that to happen. And I really can't explain it, but I can say that I wouldn't have traded it for anything in the world. There's no one would understand me the way he did. Perhaps he would say no one would understand him the way I did. A lot of it was just timing, you know. But once it started to, we started to have that closeness, there was nothing that could stop it, and who would want to? And I love him just as much now in a different way. My dancers who never met him, you know, love his works as if he were alive. I had no idea that carrying, first of all, I never wanted a company. But I realized having my own dancers allowed me to teach better because you can continually go back to the ballet and take it to another level, which was also the way I grew up under Mr. B, not just performing a piece once and then never doing it again.
It's funny, I just want to go back to something you said. You said it was so wonderful, I'm paraphrasing, who would want to stop it? And yet, at a certain point, you did put up a roadblock to it at least continuing into a physical relationship. How hard was that to do, you know, given that this is your, you know, everything you've just said about him?
It just stopped our being together for a moment. It didn't stop forever, although I had no assurance that I would return to the New York City Ballet.
Right, that some would think, you know, that you know that would be a real risk on your
part. But partner. I think it proves that we were just meant to be together.
Right.
Artistically.
Balanchine often referred to how he talked with composers like Tchaikovsky, whose music he was choreographing. Do you feel you communicate still with George Balanchine in the way that he felt he did with Tchaikovsky?
I do. And specifically in certain areas where maybe I'll have to make a choreographic and an artistic choice that might be a little different from what Mr. B had done. And I don't feel wrong in doing that, because frequently in the studio he would say, well, Susie, you know what I want. Do something here. And so he gave me that freedom. And that's the way you keep the ballet alive also.
I think we can have a slower curtain.
That's former New York City Ballet dancer Suzanne Farrell. She's speaking from the Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in Western Massachusetts. When we return, we'll ask Farrell about her rift with the New York City Ballet's current director and her former partner, Peter Martins. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Been called one of the most influential ballerinas of the 20th century. She was muse to the Russian-born choreographer George Balanchine, who founded the New York City Ballet, reshaped American ballet, and is considered one of the great creative geniuses of the past century. Balanchine called Farrell his Stradivarius, and Farrell danced in more than 100 of his ballets, nearly one-third of them created expressly for her. Quite a pair.
Okay, people, be ready for anything.
It's a little of the sound of Suzanne Farrell rehearsing her company at Jacob Pillow Dance Festival in Western Massachusetts. They're going to be performing this weekend. Her company is the Suzanne Farrell Ballet. They'll be performing the works of George Balanchine. And before the break, we were talking about Suzanne Farrell's personal and artistic relationship with Balanchine. And we want to ask now about her relationship with Peter Martins, her former dance partner, who now runs the New York City Ballet. But first, Suzanne Farrell, what is it like to see other dancers doing the many roles you originated for the man you call Mr. B? You know, do you ever stop and think, oh, see that little move? I created that moment.
I had my time. You know, it was a great time. And now it's these dancers' time. And the farther away I get from my dancing days, the farther away I see myself. I know that I did those ballets, but I don't have any pangs of doing them again. And I think that's why I like teaching and why I enjoy having a company and working, is because that was then and this is my now. That was very much Mr. B's philosophy also. And I live in the moment, and I live in this moment for myself, and I live in this moment for my dancers and for the people who come to see us as well. You know, you only have one life. You only have one moment.
And you have two artificial hips, I hear. I mean, do you dance at all?
I do. I have to show the steps, and it's fun still having those steps somewhat go through my body. The musicality is always fun.
Do you perform at all, and if not, would you like
no,
to?
No, I
would
don't.
Would you like
no.
to? Would you?
I actually would have liked to have done a Broadway play.
Ah.
Musical or drama.
Annie,
or
get
anything.
Your gun.
I love the theater. I love the theater. I wanted to go into ballet because I was on a stage in Cincinnati for the first time, a real stage, a real performance. And I got to the theater too early, and I walked out on the stage. Only the ghost light, the one single light bulb, was burning in the center of the stage. And I looked out into the dark theater, and I could feel what I call the dust of performers who had been there. And it was so palpable, and I said, this is the world I want to be in. And I get that same feeling whenever I go into a theater. I'd like to think that I left a little of my dust and we'll leave some of ours. It's, you know, it's one of the few professions that you pass on personally and impart that knowledge and that love and that commitment and the stories. And it's very special.
Huh. What a wonderful way of putting it, the dust of previous performers. I just want to ask you briefly, do you ever see yourself reconciling with Peter Martins, who is the current director of the New York City Ballet? Some critics say it's no longer the place where the Balanchine flame burns brightest, and you and Martins, your famous partner in the 70s, had a parting of the ways in 93. He dismissed you from the company in a personal dispute over direction, I guess. Bad blood between the two of you. And some say, boy, if that could be healed, it would be even, you know, better for the George Balanchine legacy, you know, if his two bright lights could come together to preserve his legacy. Do you ever see that happening?
As I said, I live in the now. I only see today. I only see my dancers. I don't prophesize.
Sounds like that was.
I'm doing what Mr. B wanted me to do. It doesn't matter where I do it. I don't change how I do it from one city to the next. You know, I do what I do. That's all I know.
It sounds, and you know, that sounds like it was quite a rift between you and Martins. I'll leave it at that. Well, former New York City Ballet principal dancer Suzanne Farrell now stages Balanchine ballets around the world, directs the Suzanne Farrell Ballet, based at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., dedicated to performing the works of George Balanchine. She's speaking to us from the beautiful Jacob's Pillow out in western Massachusetts. And Suzanne, we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
I would just like to add one other
Please.
Thing, that yes, Mr. B's ballets are the heart of what we do, but in June at Kennedy Center, I'm doing a program of two of Mr. B's ballets and two pieces of Maurice Béjart's, mm-hmm. who I'm very close friends with also. Mm-hmm. And also we've done Robin's ballets, and I look around for interesting choreographers also for my company. So it's
looking forward as well.
Right. And also, I'd like to choreograph.
Well, come on. Let's choreograph a Broadway show.
We'll see. Anything's possible.
Suzanne, thanks so much.
Thanks.
And by the way, if you could do a Broadway play, what would it be? I mean,
it could be a drama. I acted when I was young. I guess it's the ham in me. I had mentioned it to Jerry Robbins about being in Gypsy.
Gypsy, that would
and,
be perfect.
And he said, oh, that's an intriguing idea. But he had sold his rights to the piece. He no longer had any artistic say in the matter. But, you know, but that was before I had a company. So now I'm pretty busy.
No, that makes too much shadow on the floor. Yeah.
Let me try to bring up some of the other cross-site and stuff to make them look cool.
Suzanne Farrell spoke to us from the Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in Western Massachusetts. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
Of the one-year anniversary of the London bombings, one of the four suicide bombers in the attacks is seen in a video made, of course, before the attacks, saying, "What you have witnessed now is only the beginning." The video, broadcast by Al Jazeera Television, shows 22-year-old Shehzad Tanweer, who went on to kill himself and six other people aboard a London underground train. Spryker McGuire is London bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. He joins us from London. And, Spryker, where did this tape come from? It's, you know, as we said, a year since the bombings. How long has Al Jazeera had it?
Well, we don't know. I mean, it was first announced on a website, which is usually associated with Al-Qaeda, a website called Al-Sahab, which means the cloud. We don't know. I would assume that Al Jazeera has not had this tape for very long, because I don't think they're in any kind of conspiracy with Al-Qaeda. But when they got it from an Al-Qaeda intermediary is another question. I would assume that would have been very recently.
And we understand it was a very long tape that they received. They only showed a portion of it. Do we know what else is on the tape?
Well, there's a lot on it. I haven't seen the whole tape, but it's got a lot on it. It's got sort of family pictures. It has Shehzad Tanweer making his statement. It has Ayman al-Zawahiri on there.
The former, now late, leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, who was killed, I believe, on June 7th in a missile attack. Or did you say Zawahiri or Zarqawi?
Al-Zawahiri is it? You were talking about...
Oh, pardon me, of course.
Yeah, different person.
Osama bin Laden's first in command.
Yeah, this is the Egyptian... yes, exactly. This is the Egyptian doctor. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so he's on the tape as well. Are they in the same image ever on the tape?
No. And that's, you know, this could have been put together, probably was put together, and taken from different sources. There appear to be certain similarities between the image of Tanweer himself in this tape and the way Sadiq Khan appears in his tape, which came out, as you may remember, last September.
Well, let's tell people about that. Khan was another one of the suicide bombers, and as you said, a tape in which he was in a tape which already surfaced.
That surfaced in September of last year, again, in a kind of, you know, it was an anniversary-like way. It was a month after, two months after the July bombings.
Well, we know that both Tanweer in the tape released recently and Khan in the tape released a year ago had been to Pakistan at least three times. The London Metropolitan Police confirmed that. Is there any sense that the two tapes are connected?
Well, they probably are, but how they're connected, we don't know. It's tempting. I mean, indeed, it's unavoidable to see evidence in the tapes that Al-Qaeda was behind what happened in some way. But, you know, this behind what happened is such a vague term. We don't really know whether it was orchestrated by anybody in particular, or whether the connection was sort of ideological as much as anything else.
In other words, someone else might have made the tapes,
while perhaps training these suicide bombers on the tape somehow came into the hands of Al-Qaeda.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. We really don't know. And the police and the security services of this country also don't know the full story yet. They have plenty to worry about, but they don't know the full story yet.
Well, and this comes at a time, as we said, when it's the first year anniversary, and there's a lot of tension over the investigation into what happened a year ago, and tensions between Prime Minister Tony Blair and the Muslim community. Prime Minister Blair saying this week, the government itself cannot go and root out the extremism in communities. He went on to say communities have to do that within communities, and the Muslim community, of course, reacted.
Yes. Now, I would I think we want to be a little bit careful here, because first of all, when you say the Muslim community reacted, mm-hmm. well, you know, there are many Muslim communities coming from all sorts of ethnic and national backgrounds. They don't always agree. There are many Muslim groups. I think yes, of course, there are tensions. They do exist, and as you know, there was a poll that came out earlier this week that has some disturbing results in it about what some Muslims feel about the bombers last year and about the country in which they live.
Well, let's give some of those numbers. It was conducted by The Times and ITV News.
Correct.
And it found that 16% of surveyed British Muslims believed the attackers last year were motivated by a just cause. And 13% of the respondents felt the bombers should be regarded as martyrs. 7% felt suicide attacks on British civilians were justified in some circumstances.
Yes. And those numbers, while small, are, as you suggested in your question about tensions, they are disturbing numbers. Mm-hmm. Of course, the great difference between what happened here in London and what happened in the United States on 9/11 was the fact that these boys, as they're called, of course they're all adults, but these boys were born in this country.
They're British born. Well, and when I say tensions, I there are very many communities, and many of them are expressing tensions. The poor working class community where the kids came from are getting frustrated that people think it's something having to do with them that produced these bombers. And then other, you might say more professional class Muslims in Britain are wondering, why haven't we found out more in the investigation?
Yes, that's right. And equally, there are many mainstream, for lack of a better word, Muslim groups and Muslim leaders who on a virtually daily basis condemn what happened last year and talk about the need for communities to work together, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And we just have about a minute left, Spryker. I just want to ask, how is this tape reverberating in London, especially because of the anniversary?
Well, you know, of course, it's a big story, but it doesn't. This is not really a surprise. I mean, we had the tape last year, which was all the more disturbing because even though we knew that Sadiq Khan was born in this country, to see this, to see this man who was a teaching assistant, and to hear him talk in a Yorkshire accent was very disturbing to people. What we're seeing here is basically a repetition of that, so it doesn't have quite the same shock value, but it does come, as you say, on the eve of the anniversary, and many people will find it unnerving. Mm.
Spryker McGuire, London Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine, speaking to us from London. New tapes surfaced. It's actually an old tape that has surfaced anew of one of the suicide bombers from last year's London attacks. Speaking of more attacks to come, but of course that tape was made before last year's attack. Spryker, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Of course, thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And President Bush spent part of his 60th birthday today meeting with his counterpart to the North, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Harper rose to power in January, becoming the first Conservative Party Prime Minister in a dozen years. Over the last 7 months, the Prime Minister has rattled some Canadians by trying to whittle down or eliminate social programs, questioning socialized medicine, some say cozying up to the U.S. Today's meeting with President Bush, somewhat of a tightrope walk for the Prime Minister, who considers good relations with the U.S. essential but doesn't want to further alienate Canadian voters. Here's Stephen Harper at his joint press conference with the president.
The United States and Canada have a strong relationship, strong and firm relationship based on the largest commerce and social interaction in the history of any two countries of the world. And we were able to discuss a wide range of bilateral and international matters where we more often than not share common values and common objectives.
Louisa Savage is Washington Bureau Chief for Canada's Maclean's magazine. She joins us from Washington. And Louisa, start by telling us, what are the main issues being discussed between the two leaders? I understand, you know, they're different. Each has a different agenda.
That's right. There are two categories of issue that was talked about at this meeting, as is usually the case when Canada and the U.S. get together. The Canadians have a list of bilateral issues that are very important to their economy and to what's going on in their country. And usually it's the case, as was this time around, that the United States wants to talk to Canada about international affairs, about diplomacy, about multilateral efforts. So today you had President Bush talking to Stephen Harper about how to respond to nuclear rocket tests out of North Korea. About diplomacy, working with other countries to put pressure on Kim Jong-il to speak with United Voice after their meeting. President Bush underscored several times that the solution to this problem needs to be diplomatic, that everyone has to be on the same page, and that he'd spent his morning talking to different foreign leaders, including Stephen Harper, face-to-face. Mm-hmm. On the Canadian side, the issues are very specific. The overriding issue right now for Canada is a law that's been passed by the U.S. Congress which will require passports of anyone crossing the Canada-U.S. border beginning for the air and sea crossings beginning next January and a year later for the land border. And when you've got a border that sees some $5 billion in trade every day, it's a big concern for the country, which relies so heavily on tourism and on trade with the United States.
It's definitely going to slow things down.
Well, it's not just a question of slowing down. It's a question of completely discouraging trade and traffic from the U.S. For example, the Niagara region that relies so heavily on American tourists counts on families getting in their cars from the American Midwest and driving up to see the falls. And now if you tell these people that they need passports and fewer than 24% of Americans have passports, you know, the idea of buying a passport for you and your spouse and your three kids and your aunt and doing this all in time for your vacation, you know, will make a lot of people say, well, maybe we'll vacation somewhere else. So this is a big concern.
Well, Louisa, I'm sure a lot of Americans are saying this is fascinating that Stephen Harper feels this way. And I'm sure others are saying, who is Stephen Harper? He's been very low key, at least as far as Americans knowing about him. We understand he's intensely private. He doesn't like talking to the press. He refused to answer questions in May at a press conference. He's not charismatic. But how else is he different from his predecessor, Liberal Prime Minister Paul Martin?
Well, there are many differences, obviously, of policy. He's a conservative politician, and Paul Martin was a liberal.
Very much against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And...
Well, Stephen Harper was for those wars, and Martin was against them.
Right.
Right now, the leading political issue in Canada is Canada's participation in Afghanistan. Canada has some 2,300 troops on the ground right now and is starting to see a lot more casualties than Canadians are used to. And there was a vote in the parliament to extend that mission to 2009, and it's in a particularly dangerous part of Afghanistan in the south. So the Liberal Party, which since Martin was defeated in January, has been trying to find a new leader. And so the leadership candidates in the Liberal Party themselves are split on whether Canada should continue its presence in Afghanistan or not. And Harper has come out very strongly in favor of using Bush's language, we can't cut and run.
Right.
We need to stay the course.
I'm sure language that's music to President Bush's ears. And meanwhile, Americans will get to know him a lot better through this trip. Louisa Savage, Washington Bureau correspondent for Canada's Maclean's News Magazine. Louisa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now.
I'd have to issue an advisory about a segment on maps, but here goes. Warning, some of the language in the following conversation about maps may be upsetting for some, but that's the point. Because the maps in question contain towns and geographical references that have raised ire and eyebrows, places such as Brazier Hill and Molly's Nipple, or Niggerhead Point and Chink's Peak. Syracuse University geography professor Mark Monnier has been studying these names to learn what they say about Americans. His new book is called From Squaw Tit to Whorehouse Meadow, How Maps Name, Claim, and Inflame. And he joins us from the studios of WAER Radio in Syracuse, New York. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I am fine.
And I'm glad that you said that rather than me.
That we sort of thought, well, that's the thing we have to tackle to do this story. We have to say the names that are, you know, that do inflame, such as Squaw Tit. Let's briefly revisit the history of the word squaw, which we're reminded by you is a real pejorative to many Native Americans. It's the equivalent of a curse word for a woman's anatomy.
That's correct. It seemed to enrage a lot of Native Americans in the early 1990s, and then things really got moving to the point where cartographers, when federal agencies are concerned with map making, are nowadays quite embarrassed by it, even though there are people who study these things and claim that there is really no historical link with the current pejorative connotation.
Well, there was a corresponding move to change some of these offensive names, which had hilarious results, I'm reminded, in Maine.
Oh, that's right.
Tell us about that.
They had a difficulty because basically the U.S. Board on Geographic Names, which is concerned with these place names, requires that you simply cannot take a name off the map. You have to replace it with something. And it has to be a name which somehow or the other has some local meaning. So some people up in a county in Maine where they had, I think, 20-some squaw place names, they sort of threw up their hands and they said, okay, simply replace squaw with moose, which is a term that has a lot of salience in Maine.
Sure.
The U.S. Board on Geographic Names didn't buy it.
Well, if Maine, in fact, had been able to just simply replace the word squaw with the word moose, they would have had the unlikely name of Moose Bosom on one of the mountains. One of the cases where people objected, but they were, you know, it was overridden, was at Cape Canaveral in Florida, which was renamed Cape Kennedy. And a lot of people objected to that.
That's right. Canaveral actually is a very old name. Also, too, Florida residents really didn't like the fact that Lyndon Johnson, who was president at the time, decided rather unilaterally that not just the space agency facility there, but the actual landscape feature itself was going to be renamed. Some of the Florida people said, well, look, President Kennedy was from Massachusetts. Why don't you rename Cape Cod? But probably the resistance from Massachusetts was going to be much greater than it was from Florida.
Yeah. And I want to touch on the word that is so offensive to so many people, no matter what color. And again, we apologize, but just to be able to talk about it, we have to say it, and that's the word nigger. I mean, the places that were named that, in some cases, and I'm thinking of the upstate New York spot that was actually a point along the Underground Railroad. It was an honorary name.
Oh, it's a little bit east of Rochester, a feature by the name of Niggerhead Point. And in fact, federal maps still use that name. Well, excuse me, I should take that back. Back in the 1960s, all features that were named Nigger were replaced with Negro. So that currently, that feature east of Rochester is called Niggerhead Point. It so happened, however, that in the 1970s, the word Negro became offensive. There was the issue of, well, do we change it to black or African American, which was probably a bit cumbersome. Generally speaking, features that are now named Negro stay on our maps unless somebody comes up with a proposal to name them something else.
Hmm. There was also a federal edict to replace Jap with Japanese.
That's correct.
And then if names weren't racial or ethnic insults, they were just, as we said, you know, questionable. You have the Molly's Nipple. There's one in Idaho, two in Utah. Outhouse Draw, that's in Nevada.
Whorehouse Meadow in Oregon. Don't people, you know, if it's just mildly offensive, don't people, you know, like the names that have been there for so long?
Lots of people do. And in the case of Whorehouse Meadow, there was a historic link to that place name because basically it was an area where some, I guess, ladies, you might say, from a local town actually set up a tent there. And this was used to, I guess, service local ranch hands. And as far as local historians are concerned, this is a significant name. When the Bureau of Land Management decided that they didn't want it on their maps, there was quite an uproar. Now, one thing I think which is worth noting is that by and large, these offensive names are really mostly in very remote places. One exception, however, was in Phoenix, Arizona, where towering over the city of Phoenix was Squaw Peak. An interesting thing there is that there was a Native American female soldier who was killed very early in the Iraq War, Lurie Piastriwa.
Sure, she was driving in that convoy.
That's right. And when Arizona's governor, who was concerned about the controversy over this name, said, okay, well, let's use this as an opportunity to rename this peak. And the problem is there's a federal rule that said you cannot name a cartographic feature after somebody who's been dead less than 5 years. So it's likely that when the 5 years is up, the new name is going to appear on federal maps. It's there already on state of Arizona maps.
Well, what do you see as the next big field of objectionable names?
I would think possibly we have a number of features, let's say, which are named Dago.
Of course, a pejorative for Italians.
Oh, and Spanish in some cases as well.
Really?
Yeah. We also have a few features which have the word Jew. One example, I believe this is down in Georgia, there is Jewfish Creek. And there is, in fact, a fish, which is the Jewfish. And a few people down there got rather upset about it. Someone, in fact, was able to get the organization which is responsible for species names to actually rename the fish, which is now called the Goliath grouper. Hmm. But as far as the place name is concerned, it remains Jewfish Creek.
Mark Monmanier, and you know what? I'm not going to say your book title again.
Yeah.
But what a fascinating thing. Although, if somebody tunes in halfway through, I just would love to see the reaction of somebody when all these words are coming out. None of them we ever say on public radio.
Well, you know, one of the things, there is a place in Austria. They have a lot of problems over there with people stealing highway signs, which have this place's name on it.
What was the name of it?
Well, if you want to bleep it, it's called F***ing. And it's named after a family because basically there's a word which has one connotation in English and a very different connotation, obviously, in German.
So people are stealing that sign?
People are stealing the sign.
I think it's time to change that name. Mark Monmanier, his book. Well, I'm not going to say the title again. We've said enough, Mark.
Okay.
But thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.